I am Roy Malloy, and this is the Dawn of Crime podcast yet again. Been a long time since I put anything on this podcast, and for that I apologise. There's a good reason. There's a reason. I don't know if it's a good reason, but I keep myself pretty busy across several kinds of social media. And in particular, I guess my writing comes first. I try and keep on top of my writing, and I published the Dolly Gray biography about a month and a half back, 2 months back. That really took a lot of my time up. And then before that, between Squizzy Taylor being published in December 2020 and then Dolly Gray, it's nearly 2 years, I stopped really working on big projects as a single kind of occupation. And I've now got, I think, 6 different books all half finished and in the pipes. So I think the focus it required of me on Squizzy Taylor was such that I don't want to say burnt out, but you do kind of need a break. And so that's how I did it. I started moving my attentions between several different projects. I'll talk you through some of them in a minute. But one of the things that I've also been meaning to get back to, and that's a series of TikTok videos I was making called The Tragedies. Another word for it is the horrors, and it's a series of videos I made about a kind of media and social thing that used to happen that kind of finished around about the time of World War I, and I think it's probably fair to say that the horror that we experienced as a collective community in World War I replaced the role that these things had in our media and in society after there. But prior to World War I, what would happen is no different. They still happen, unfortunately, is you'll get some situation where a person does something absolutely horrific, usually involving the murder of someone in their house, or they kill somebody. And then the media would explode, but they would refer to this horrific incident as the tragedy, and then they'd name the suburb that went with it. So you get, for example, the Moonee Ponds tragedy. And that was a situation where a mother who was suffering a huge amount of psychological stuff hacked one of her children to death in the backyard. So you get this explosion the next day of the Moonee Ponds tragedy, and then the media will keep referring to it as there's been a development in the Moonee Ponds tragedy. And so with the TikTok videos, I became aware in my research with a lot of the different projects I'm doing that when I'm researching the project, I almost always find an address where the crime happens, especially if it's before World War I. You get a lot of the media recording the address. And then I'll go into Google Maps and I'll just punch in the address, and it almost always comes up with the house still standing there. And so when I was kind of passing by a suburb called Albion. It's near Sunshine, just near where I live. And I was coming home from work one night, and I'd been reading about this tragedy where this fellow had been under a huge amount of emotional turmoil. His wife had died from consumption not long ago. He had it. He was working 7 days a week at a local bluestone quarry, which would be horrific work at the best of times. And he was just exhausted all the time. But he had these 3 little kids, and he put his 12 and 10-year-old sons to work in the quarry with him. And it just, I think the way I kind of read between the lines, the way I translate the media, he just burnt out. He had very little, if any, family support around him. It seems like there was some of his ex-wife's family, or his passed away wife. They were around, but he didn't want anything to do with them. And you get that in relationships, I guess. But he just worked and worked until he burnt out. And his wife's brother and sister they'd seen what was happening, and they'd made arrangements to come and swoop down and collect the children and take them up the country. And they were going to look after his children while he recovered. But I think the writing was on the wall that he knew he was about to lose his children. And in his suicide note, he wrote that he just couldn't bring himself to have worked that hard to then lose his children. And in his lodge, he was completely exhausted. But he'd also saved quite a bit of money. He wasn't destitute, but it just wasn't sustainable. And I think he just saw no way out. And then you get that a lot with suicide cases where they think this is my only solution. And it's not correct, obviously. It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. But he took a hatchet to his children and he ended their lives in that house. Now, when I was driving past the area, I thought, you know, I'll just drive past and see if that house is still there. It wasn't only just there, it was also for sale at the time. There were all the big real estate boards out the front. And so, in seeing that, I was able to jump on the internet and look at photos of the actual bedrooms. So it's in my TikTok called The Albion Tragedy. But you get to see inside the house, right? And being able to do that means that there's somebody out there who is going to buy this house completely unaware of the fact that 100 years earlier, this guy had killed his children in this house. And the media was pretty explicit about what that kind of unfolded like. And they talked about the horror that the police and the first responders encountered to discover blood halfway up the walls in three rooms. Now, remembering it was wooden floorboards as well, and probably no carpeting. I don't know that for sure, but probably. Even if there was carpeting, it might still apply that the blood would have gone through the floorboards to the earth directly underneath. And I work in a prison a lot, and I was talking to somebody who specializes in forensics, and I said, if I took a black light in the crawl space under that house, would the DNA matter still show up? And he said, yeah, probably would. That would still all glow underneath that house. So for me, I was just blown away that that can exist in the first place. So I think I've got 10 or so tragedy videos in there. They're not an easy video to make because it takes about the same kind of time to make that video, do the research, and kind of put it all together before I record it. It takes the same kind of time that it takes to write maybe half the time it takes me to write a chapter of a book that goes in the Dawn of Crime series. So, you know, they're time consuming, but I get a lot of, I find it, I don't want to say I enjoy it, but I find the research and the knowledge acquisition period extremely interesting while I do that. And I guess that brings me to what I'm working on now. I'm working on several products at the moment, which will, hopefully some of them will be published next year. But the problem I face still is that I had a car accident in 2019, only months before lockdown. And I started getting the treatment. Then we went to lockdown and obviously I was unable to get proper treatment. But what it did do was it broke my shoulder in two places and my opposite elbow in two places. So now my arms are absolutely useless. I went to had all the treatments have just begun, and the specialists have said, this is why you can't lift anything. I'm like, mate, I never stop having to work. It's what you do. You just got to keep plowing forwards. But it's been very difficult to write as much as I used to. In the lead up to that, when I was working on Squizzy, I was able to write I had a budget of 3,000 words a day. And now I'd be lucky if I can punch that out in a week. So it's really slowed me down a lot. Hopefully I can get on top of the treatment and that can be fixed. But in the meantime, I'm working on several products. One of them is the biography of Norman Brunn, the founder of the Razor Gangs, or one of the people that really took razor fighting into an organized kind of capacity and formed a gang with other fools that thought that was a bit good. I'm working on a Dawn of Crime volume, which are actually two of them. And I've got a fantastic guest writer on this one, Deb Robinson from the Geelong Jail Museum, who I'm a big fan of her work, and she's going to be collaborating with me on it. And it's looking specifically at Jack the Ripper cases that were in Australia. Some of them may have actually been real copycat cases. Some of them were referred to in the media as Jack the Ripper-like, and a couple of them are people who said, I am Jack the Ripper, but clearly were insane. So that book hopefully will also come out next year. And having said that, I found it interesting to produce the Jack the Ripper stuff, because I was really, before that, unaware of just how much overlap there was between our culture and the culture of England. Well, I also knew, though, that we considered ourselves British in Australia, really until very recently. And until my lifetime, the national anthem was God Save Our Queen as well. So it's been a fascinating kind of learning experience for me, seeing just how much these particular cases echoed English culture. And then as I'm really kind of understanding Whitechapel in 1880s, early 1890s, one of the particular cases, and probably the one that garnered the most media at the time, was a case they called the Brewery Murders, as in to brew beer, the Brewery Murders. And that took place around Collingwood in the not long after the Jack the Ripper cases in 1888. I put a lot of thought into the similarity between Whitechapel and Collingwood at that time and period. Whitechapel had a number of buildings that were truly ancient around them. And a lot of their buildings were two stories or three, whereas Collingwood had predominantly lower one-story buildings. But the kind of close proximity of the streets and the back alleys in Collingwood would have made it feel remarkably similar to Whitechapel around that time, I believe. I think you would have been surrounded by all the same smells, and we kind of overlook what smell, well, the role that smell played in that time and period of the world, because in particular drainage was appalling. Like, I mean, it was just all gravity run out to the sea, but there were, anytime there was any kind of water, it pulled for not just a little bit of time, it pulled for days and days. In summer it gave you mosquitoes, gave you cholera, wasn't uncommon. So all the drains just stunk of that kind of gross grey water excrement. Horses were everywhere, and fortunately I think that of all the different excrements, horse is probably one of the lesser offensive, but still it was everywhere. And you had guys who had a particular job, like their actual job was just to scrape the horse poop off the street. Interestingly, Norman Brunn had a brother, I think it was his brother, it might have been him, Norman Brunn, that was his actual job, was cleaning up the horse poop in Geelong. And dogs and cats were everywhere. So I grew up watching Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, with Bugs Bunny and that kind of thing. And there was a series of cartoons with Sylvester, and the main theme was the dog and the cat catcher, you know, this guy with the van and the big net. And these days it just doesn't apply to us because we don't see that, and it's not a role in society anymore. But at that time, dogs and cats were everywhere. You could barely walk down a back street without seeing just dogs and cats roaming all over the place. And so often I'll be looking at photos from that time and period, and you'll see dogs and cats just doshing in the background. They added to the smell. They kill vermin, and they left bits of carcass everywhere, very small bits, but that added to the smell, you know. And people discarded anything that they couldn't deal with anywhere they could, really. And I'll give you an example as to why. These days, every Tuesday night, my wheelie bin is collected by the council, and so all the things I want to chuck out go in one of three bins. But prior to just prior to my lifetime, really, you had one bin, and it wasn't very big. That's all you're allowed, and you're kind of given a small bin to encourage you to recycle in ways that we don't now. So most backyards, if not every backyard, had an incinerator, and the incinerator was a cinder block bin, and you'd throw anything that was combustible in there, branches, cardboard, milk boxes, anything like that, went in the incinerator, and once a week you'd have a fire. And you're constantly looking over your neighbour's fence to see if they had their laundry on the line, otherwise they'd growl, because the smoke would make their clothes stink, you know. So we were constantly burning fires, to get rid of that, because there was no other way to recycle it. So then, you know, you had that layer of smell on everything, was smoke. And these days you kind of smell someone with an open fire, and you think, oh, that's charming, but it wasn't. It was in everything. But the smoke in your clothes also kept the bed bugs and the fleas out of your clothes a bit. So people weren't discouraged from smelling like smoke. I mean, it was a useful thing. And routinely people would hang their clothes up in a covered place that, you know, wouldn't get wet if it rained, but they would air their clothes on a coat hanger under an evening in the evening, at night, they'd kind of hang up all their clothes on the veranda just to get some air through them to get rid of that stench. They didn't have deodorant. So my mum's mum, my nana, she grew up in a time period in the, through the 20s when deodorant wasn't a thing. She wore deodorant when she was going to Salvation Army Training College, and she commented that people said she was, and the word was, she said, people said she was fast because she wore deodorant. What they would do instead is they'd sew little bags of lavender into their armpits. And the expression that excused that was they said, he smells of work. And that was a virtue, it was a good thing, but it was excusable because everybody else stunk of body odour, you know. Being in this time and period, it was a gross, small time to be alive, especially in a suburb like Collingwood or Whitechapel, where it was also built up and you got high density of people all living together. And so you get this situation where they start finding these bodies in Collingwood in this time and period in the world that resembles Whitechapel. And some of the people who were investigating this would probably have been to Whitechapel. So they're investigating these murders where women are showing up, three of them in total, and they've got horrific life-ending abdominal wounds. Now, I kind of also found it fascinating that the policing was so underdeveloped back then that the police looked at this first victim and they couldn't identify her, and they had an inquest, they had a jury, so it was treated pretty seriously, or as seriously as they could. And they found that she died from an abdominal wound that was probably caused, they believed, by her climbing the fence of a local park that had spear top on the iron fence. And that spear topping punctured her stomach and ripped it open, and she crawled to her death a short distance later. I don't know if you've seen the kinds of spear top fences I'm talking about. They still exist. And the spear isn't in the least bit sharp. It would be like about as sharp as the handle of a hammer, right? They're not sharp. And so it was just impossible to think that this woman could have done that. But that was the only conclusion they could come to. Nonetheless, she passed away, and her family showed up a few months later, and they claimed the body and said, look, she'd fallen on hard times. She started drinking heavily. There's an insinuation that she'd also hit probably opium and was prostituting to stay alive, but she'd previously, like so many of the victims of the Whitechapel murders, she had a respectful life. She'd been married, she'd had a domestic normal style life, and we see that again and again with the Whitechapel victims. So it kind of goes through the next two victims for various, you know, and it describes them, but in putting this book together about the Australian Jack the Ripper victims, I'm fascinated by the fact that we've forgotten. I often wonder what makes a community remember something. Australians, as a rule, we are rubbish at remembering our own stories. I think it's an embarrassment that we've stolen the First Nations stories. We deleted them at colonisation, and each of those 250-odd Aboriginal countries had their own stories, their own folklore, their own legends, their own customs, traditions, celebrations, festivals, and they were, in a generation, deleted. So it's like, you know, an invading force coming to Australia now and deleting Melbourne Cup, deleting Grand Final, but also deleting all memory of it. So you adopt the colonizers' festivals and celebrations, but your children don't even remember that you once had Grand Final every year, you had Easter every year. I mean, really, all their most significant things, Christmas, gone. And so we've deleted everything that was prior to the late 1780s. I don't know if they're linked, but, you know, as a modern day society, we're terrible at remembering our own stories. It's almost like we've said, here are the stories you can remember, Ned Kelly. You know, one or two famous stories, but that's it. Even if you say to the average Australian, who was Captain Moonlight or who was Ben Hall, they might have a vague knowledge. But if you said to them in comparison, who was Bonnie and Clyde, what was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, who was Al Capone, who was Billy the Kid, we'd rattle it off. And it also has to do a bit with the fact that we don't have enough funding or take up in a commercial sense from making our own movies and our own television products. I don't see Netflix banging on the door of Australian producers saying, where's your material? You know, can we make... And Underbelly did a fantastic service for us. It also proved yet again that people are really interested in it. We will watch your product if you can make a high-budget version of, you know, our own stories. But where are they? I don't see Films Victoria working with Netflix and Stan and, you know, all those different streaming services to make Australian biographical content. So perhaps the reason we're terrible at remembering our own stories is the fact that, A, there's no researchers looking into it. B, we're not seeing enough proactive resourcing of good writers and producers making our own content. Is it impossible that we could have ABC start a streaming service just for this kind of content? It's feasible. But, you know, with ABC always having their funding threatened in the first place by whichever government wants to take that funding and put it towards more Grand Prix and sporting events, I mean, typically speaking, that tends to be part of the problem as well. But, you know, back to the topic is that I've got several book products on the run at the same time, and I'm going to be starting to work on some more TikTok stuff. Lastly, I'll just talk about what I've been doing on TikTok. It's probably lower-hanging fruit. So I've been able to enjoy researching different buildings that are in my area, and it gave me an opportunity to look and see which buildings are still standing from, you know, 100 years ago, print a photo, hold it up in front of the building, and then show you what the building looks like now. And I find that kind of ghost of its former self fascinating. You know, the people standing out the front 100 years ago, all of them are, you know, no longer, they're passed away. And the building kind of has that link to those people, that you can stand in exactly the same spot that the fellow who built the building stood so proudly with his family. And I remember a time when I stood with my family at the front of a theatre that I built so proudly. You know, I no longer own it, and there's that kind of magic with the bittersweet passing of time. So jump on my TikTok and check them out if they're of any interest, but also check out the tragedies videos. They're a bit further down if you're scrolling through my videos. So I'm Roy Malloy 4. You've got to put the number 4. Yes, there are 3 other Roy Malloys out there. I don't know what they're doing with their channels. Maybe go have a look. But, you know, they're on my TikTok as well. I also put a link tree on my bio. So when you're looking at my Roy Malloy, there's a bio, there's a link tree. You can give me a tip. You can financially fund the projects I'm doing, like this podcast, through there. It goes to my PayPal, and that funds my history habit. I've got a couple of public lectures coming up over the next 12 months. One of them is hopefully a book launch, which will be at a library in the city of Yarra, talking about 1920s Australian gangsters and Squeezy Taylor in particular. And I'll be doing a couple of other public lectures next year, early next year, in one in Geelong, one in Melbourne. And I'd love all of you to come along, and I'll be obviously talking about that, you know, when I'm heading towards those kinds of dates. And that also does put out the invitation if you have an event that you're looking for a speaker at. I do a lot of public speaking, and I feel I'm getting better at it. I've done all the stand-up comedy in the world and all the circus performing in my earlier days, but, you know, this kind of material can often be a bit dry, so I've worked very hard to make it interesting and also humorous where I can, and that's a tricky balance to keep something so sensitive also entertaining, because it's got to be respectful to the fact that these were actual people who passed away, and being inappropriate can be disrespectful. But yeah, look, if you have an event of any kind where you're looking for a speaker, I'm always looking for an opportunity to talk about the books I've written, so I really enjoy that opportunity when I have the time and it arises. But in the meantime, thank you all for following. Do me a favour, share some of my material, whether it be some of the old articles I've written on my Facebook, which is Roy Malloy Author. You've got to write the word author or it doesn't take you to the right place. If you're a reader, there's heaps of stuff on there that I've published for free. And if you have any of your own material, like a family story that you want me to consider, I'm always looking for that kind of stuff as well, because when you get in touch with the family, they have information, photographs that you just can't ever research. Things like, I discovered from Dolly Gray's family that she smoked heavily. And you'd never be able to find that in the media. They wouldn't talk about that because everybody smoked. There was an assumption that she smoked. So being able to find the family and have them tell me that she smoked heavily, and then also knowing that how she died gives you a pretty clear link that she died of probably smoking-related, health conditions. So if you do have a family story, I'm always looking for that kind of material. And I'd love you to reach out to me at any of the usual platforms, Instagram as well. But in the meantime, go well, and thanks for following.